My name is Michael McCusker. Today is a busy day in terms of anniversaries and birthdays, but first I'd like to leapfrog over till tomorrow. My friend Jesse Torres is going to be 60 tomorrow, Saturday, the 10th of August. So if you think about it, go over to the Ship Inn and give him a high five. I mean, he's 60. That's a milestone. And today is also the birthday of my used-to-be chum and sidekick, Farzan Kamali. And one of the anniversaries of today is that the USS Astoria sank 70 years ago in the Battle of Savo Sea off Guadalcanal. One of five American cruisers that went down. It was a bit of a slaughter that night. Two days after the U.S. invasion of Guadalcanal on August 7th. And today's birthday, jumping back and forth, Margaret Leah Bowler is 23 today. She is somewhere in Australia, and she sent a story from there back in June, and I decided to hold it till today, which is her birthday. And she is, at the moment, a Fulbright scholar in Australia doing field work in linguistics and graduated from Astoria High School in 2007 and Reed College in 2011. And, of course, you might remember when she was 4 years old doing children's stories along with her father, Lloyd Bowler. And she sent this off in June. It's called Sorry Business. And if I pronounce it wrong, I am sorry. UN Dumu by Margaret Leah Bowler. Yesterday, and that would have been June 17th, 2012, was the funeral for Nakamura, a Walpiri old elder, talented artist, teacher, and my friend. I also worked closely with two of her children for my project. The funeral began at UN Dumu Baptist Church. Josh and I picked up one of the Art Center troopies to take people to the burial place afterwards and headed over around 2 p.m. There were maybe 200 people at the church when we arrived. Unlike at Western funerals where people dress primarily in black, at Walpiri funerals people dress in sharp white and black together, white shirts and black pants or skirts. Nearly everyone I had met in UN Dumu was there. It was appropriate that my last day in UN Dumu would be spent with the full cast of characters. Every one of the people who taught me Walpiri for my project. Every one of the artists from the center. We were all together to miss and feel sorry for Nakamura. Eventually, a car arrived bearing her casket. Her family formed two lines to bring the casket into the church. The crying started, and it didn't stop until after the sun had set. I had heard this sound before. I heard it when the young man died several months ago, and I heard it when Nakamura first passed away. The sound is piercing and heavy in its sorrow. It sits in your stomach. The church was completely full, so I stood against the wall in the back. The Stations of the Cross were painted in Walpiri iconography on the walls. Red and white stained glass windows showed Dreamtime Kuruwaris. Dogs circulated in and out of the church, competing with me for floor space. Eulogies were given in Walpiri, then some in English, then some in both Walpiri and English together. Walpiri funerals are different from Western funerals also because Nakamura's name is now taboo. People got around this by saying Nakamura, her skin name, Kumujaya, the name for a person who has died, or even this old lady. The howling continued through all the songs and the prayers. In Walpiri culture, you're not expected to grieve silently. After the eulogies ended, people stood and formed a long line to pay their respects to Nakamura. One by one, we were invited to lay ourselves against her casket and say goodbye to her. The line was very long. Parents placed young kids on the smooth wood, and the kids wailed. Many people carried flowers. Her family surrounded the casket like they had the whole funeral, holding it and crying. I gave my bunch of yellow flowers to her family and pressed my forehead against her casket. Warm hands rubbed my hair and back. Voices comforted me in Walpiri and English. "We arpa, we arpa, poor thing," said both for Nakamara, who is gone, and for me, who was crying. I hugged her daughters, and we felt sorry together. I left the church, and went out into the very bright sun. Wilya arpa is a funny word. It's an expression of pity. Poor thing. I guess it isn't so much as the meaning of the word as the way it gets used that interests me. It gets handed out freely. Driving down the road with Nangala at sunset, she says, "Next time we see a kangaroo, you hit him, kill him, and we take him home and cook him. We arpa." And that's in parentheses, and God knows whether I'm pronouncing that right or not. The next stage of the funeral involved taking the casket out to Nakamara's home country. Country is so important that it transcends all other considerations of burial sites. Her late husband, Japalajari, is buried not with her, but on his country at Kintore. At this point, we took a break and went home for a bit, and by the time we'd gone back to the church with the troopy to round people up, it was deserted. We'd blown it. Too late. We drove past Meaning to see if anyone there needed a lift, and three young Walpiri ladies jumped in. This was fortunate, since we had no idea where we were going. However, it was also somewhat comical, because Walpiri directions are typically given using cardinal terms, north, south, east, west, instead of left and right. After the first turn, Kerlara, west, and another, Kerlira, south, with plenty of laughing and shouting, we spotted the dust kicked up by the preceding car and followed after them. Nakamara's country is gorgeous. She's buried at the foot of two red stone hills in a clearing with ghost gums around the graves. Her other relatives are out there, too. It was close to 6 p.m. at this point, and the sun turned everything gold. A single airplane flew across the sky. The area was packed with cars and people and the dogs that had come along with them. Her family sat around her casket and cried. Someone spoke briefly in Walpiri and English, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Her children threw themselves across her casket and howled. The grave was over 2 meters deep. It took 5 or 6 young men to carry the casket down and climb out afterwards, their white shirts dark with red dirt. The howling intensified and swelled until it was the only thing I could hear. Lowering the casket seemed to last for ages, although I'm sure it was only a matter of minutes. The sadness was so intense you could feel it like the sun or the wind. We threw fistfuls of red dirt into her grave. A backhoe completed the job. The sun was down now, and the stone hills to the west were just silhouettes. The stars were coming out, the seven sisters, her daughters dreaming, the stars that bring the frost in the winter. Once Nakamara was buried, her family covered her grave with flowers. I mingled and said goodbye to everyone I knew, promising I would be back. My first admission, "I'm leaving tomorrow," was uniformly met with a look of surprise and disappointment. "Another white fella going already?" I followed this quickly with, "And I'll be back in a month," earning smiles and hugs. On the car ride back, I asked the young ladies riding with us what the name was for the stone hills at her grave. They weren't sure. "Only old people know those names now," they said. "Rest in peace, Nakamara." And that was by Margaret Leah Bowler. And her photo blog is at www.redcenter.tumblr.com. And center is spelled the English way, R-E, and Tumblr is B-L-R. And I apologize for mispronouncing words. Well, today is also an anniversary of another sort. It is the 67th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Nagasaki. Japan. And I'd like to read an article that I actually ran in my newspaper back in 1986, August 1986, the North Coast Times Eagle. And it's by Greg Mitchell, Forgotten Bomb, Forgotten City. And hold in mind that this bomb that dropped over Nagasaki was built upriver at Hanford. By Greg Mitchell. Two atomic bombs have been used in warfare, and Kenshi Hirata, a short, slight 65-year-old resident of Nagasaki, Japan, experienced both of them. When the bomb hit Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, Hirata was at work at the Mitsubishi shipyards 3 miles from Ground Zero. He escaped serious injury. After wandering around the center of Hiroshima for 2 days, however, he was emotionally devastated, and at 3 p.m. on August 8th, he caught the first train leaving the city for his hometown, Nagasaki. When the train reached Nagasaki at 10:30 the following morning, Hirata got off and headed for home, a half-hour walk. He was greeted by his mother. She was happy to see him, for she had heard that a new type of bomb had been used in Hiroshima. Hirata excitedly started describing the unearthly white flash he had observed in the sky 3 days earlier when he saw it again through the front window. "The bomb that makes this white flash must be following my every step," Hirata recalls thinking. He knew what was coming and what to do. He shouted to the members of his family, "Lie on your stomach." They hit the floor just as the blast, which had originated about 2.5 miles away, reached their house. The windows blew in, but the house stood. This time, Hirata did not go out and wander around the epicenter. In fact, he did not leave the house for weeks. "I did not want to see such sad, miserable sights again," he said, shaking his head. For Kenshi Hirata and the world, Nagasaki was the second atomic city. And just as Hiroshima exhausted Hirata's interest in the bomb, so too does that city's almost exclusively capture the world's attention today. Few journalists bother to visit Nagasaki. Even 41 years later, now 67 years later, Nagasaki is the second city and Fat Man, the forgotten bomb. Yet Nagasaki is the modern A-bomb city, the city with the most meaning for us today. When the plutonium bomb exploded above Nagasaki, it made the uranium-type bomb dropped on Hiroshima obsolete. If Hiroshima indicated how cheap life had become in the atomic age, Nagasaki showed that it could be judged to have no value whatsoever. And this can be said as well. Hiroshima was the last casualty of World War II, Nagasaki the first victim of the Cold War. A beautiful city dotted with palm trees built on hills surrounding a harbor, Nagasaki has a rich, bloody history, as any reader of Shogun knows. 3 centuries before Commodore Perry came to Japan, Nagasaki was the country's gateway to the West. The Portuguese and Dutch settled there in the 1500s. St. Francis Xavier established the first Catholic churches in the area in 1549, and Urakami, a suburb of Nagasaki, became the Catholic center. 300 years before the atomic catastrophe, Nagasaki experienced its first massacre when 37,000 Catholic peasants were slain, yet Catholicism survived in the region. While the rest of the country was closed to the west, Nagasaki, which rests on the island of Kyushu in the westernmost part of Japan, remained open for trade. The most famous name in Nagasaki today is Thomas Glover, one of the first English traders in 19th century Japan who supplied the modern rifles that helped defeat the Tokugawa shogunate. Glover's life served as a model for the story of Madama Butterfly, and Nagasaki is better known in many parts of the world for Butterfly than for the bomb. In Puccini's opera, Madame Butterfly, standing on the veranda of Glover's home overlooking the harbor, sings, "One fine day we'll see a thread of smoke arising." If she could have looked north from Glover's mansion, now Nagasaki's top tourist attraction, on August 9, 1945, she would have seen 2 miles in the distance a thread of smoke with a mushroom cap. By 1945, Nagasaki had become a Mitsubishi company town, turning out ships and armaments for Japan's increasingly desperate war effort. It was the Christian center of the country, with more than 10,000 Catholics among its 250,000 residents. Most of them lived in the outlying Urakami district, where a magnificent cathedral seating 6,000 had been built almost brick by brick by the parishioners. At 11:02 a.m. on August 9, 1945, Fat Man was detonated almost directly over the Urakami Cathedral, which was utterly destroyed. A visitor to Nagasaki who had just been to Hiroshima, few make these trips in the reverse order, senses almost immediately that there was a world of difference between the two bombings. Hiroshima rests in a bowl surrounded by hills. The entire city was wiped out by the bomb, and that was called Little Boy, that bomb. And one can look out at Hiroshima from any elevated spot, even a hotel room, and visualize how the bomb, Little Boy, went off at a point directly above the middle of the bowl. Nagasaki, only half the size of Hiroshima, is nevertheless harder to grasp. It is a congested city that fans out from the harbor in two deep valleys separated by a high ridge. Boxcar, and that's B-O-C-K, the B-29 bearing fat man, was supposed to drop its payload right over the Mitsubishi shipyards at the end of the harbor, but Nagasaki was obscured by clouds that morning, and Bombardier Kermit Behan let the bomb go a mile up the Urakami River. Some 30,000 residents of the Urakami Valley perished instantly, and another 45,000 or more have died since, and probably many more since this was written. Those living in the Nagasaki Valley on the other side of the mountain saw the white flash, felt the blast, and heard the roar, but escaped the thermal rays and firestorms. They were fortunate. The plutonium bomb exploded with the force of 22 kilotons, almost double the uranium bomb's blast in Hiroshima. Looking through a book of pictures taken in the atomic cities in 1945, one is struck by the fact that the most horrifying photographs, the snapshots from hell, were taken in Nagasaki. If Fat Man had landed on target, the death toll in Nagasaki would have made Hiroshima, in at least one important sense, the second city. The United States succeeded that day in killing only 75,000 human beings, though it attempted to exterminate 200,000. Even in Nagasaki, this point was largely ignored. In Hiroshima, total devastation placed everyone who survived on the same footing. But in Nagasaki, half the city withstood the bombing. Many who lost their homes and families survived because they were at work in another section of the city. Afterwards, they felt paralyzing guilt. Also, Nagasaki is surrounded by mountains. Or not surrounded by it, but has mountains interlaced throughout it, little hills, which help block the blast. While Hiroshima, where everyone was in the same boat, rushed to rebuild, relief efforts in Nagasaki were slowed. The Urakami suburb had only become part of the city 25 years before, says Shinji Takahashi, a young sociologist in Nagasaki and an expert on the social effects of the bombing. It was new to a city with a very long history. All of the municipal offices were far away and mostly undamaged, so there was an administrative as well as a psychological problem. Today, many tourists visit the Glover Mansion, which was untouched by the bombing and never set foot in Urakami. A 1970 survey of 1,000 high school students in Nagasaki revealed that fewer than 15% could name the date of the atomic bombing of their city, and 19% did not know that the United States was responsible. The Catholic character of Nagasaki contributed to the divisiveness. Many adherents of Shinto and Buddhism in the city tried to disassociate themselves from the shame of the bombing. They called the atomic device the Urakami bomb and found it significant that the bomb was dropped on the Catholic section. The most influential man in Nagasaki following the bombing was the Catholic physician, Takashi Nagai, who became famous for his heroic efforts caring for the victims and wrote many books about his experience. But Nagai, as Sadao Kamata, a scholar at the Nagasaki Institute of Applied Sciences, says, transformed the bombing into martyrdom, an act of virtue. God, Nagai argued, had selected Urakami as a sacrifice to end the bloodshed of World War II. These words had a tremendous calming influence in Nagasaki, and for more than three decades they effectively silenced political protest by those most ravaged by the bomb. Hiroshima built a beautiful peace park in the center of the city and provided it with a museum and dozens of striking memorials to the dead. After much debate, it left standing at the edge of the park the half-destroyed A-bomb dome, and that's a quote, which has become the symbol of the bombing around the world. Hiroshima proudly proclaims itself a peace city, and its mayors have inevitably been hibakusha, survivors of the bombing. The Peace Park in Nagasaki is smaller, less impressive, and somewhat off the beaten path. The building which displays the city's A-bomb artifacts is not a peace museum, but an international cultural hall. Its major monument is not a graceful cenotaph, but a stupendous muscle-bound statue that looks like a cross between Buddha and Arnold Schwarzenegger. A visitor to Hiroshima feels touched or overwhelmed by the atomic tragedy in a matter of minutes. Some leave Nagasaki unmoved, confused. For years, it was said in Japan that while Hiroshima agitated for peace, Nagasaki simply prayed. But this began to change in 1981 when Pope John Paul II visited the city and told 50,000 Catholics at a mass that God was not responsible for the bombing. Humanity was, and humanity should do something about getting rid of nuclear weapons, and soon. Many in Nagasaki finally studied the reasons for the bombing and began expressing pent-up resentments. Now Nagasaki, not Hiroshima, where peace has been institutionalized and brightly packaged, is the angry A-bomb city. But why is Nagasaki angry? Brutal and unnecessary as it may have been, the bombing of Hiroshima was cloaked in high drama. It was inexorable, precise, and possibly even militarily significant. Nothing adorns the bombing of Nagasaki except chance, cynicism, and cold-blooded slaughter. We are the inferior A-bomb city, says sociologist Takahashi. Nagasaki, in fact, was not on the original list of U.S. atomic targets. It met the criteria. It was a militarized city, so the bombing could be justified, and had not already been leveled by conventional bombing, which most of the cities in Japan had been, so the effects of the bomb could be studied more easily. But it was added to the list only after Secretary of War Henry Stimson objected to Kyoto as a target. Stimson felt that destroying Japan's most historic and revered city would turn the Japanese people away from the United States and possibly toward the Soviet Union after the war. And so, on July 24, 1945, Kyoto was dropped from the list and Nagasaki added. Just like that, hundreds of thousands of people in one city were spared, and thousands of others elsewhere were marked for death. As late as the morning of August 9th, Nagasaki had a chance to escape when the airplane, the B-29 boxcar, took off from Tinian, the island in the Pacific. At 3:49 a.m., Kokura, another city on Kyushu, just west of Hiroshima, was its primary target. But Kokura was obscured by clouds, and after making three passes over the city, the B-29 turned southwest towards Nagasaki. The crew knew it only had enough fuel to make one run over Nagasaki, and when they got there, that target, too, was hidden. But a hole opened in the clouds, and Nagasaki, so close to reprieve, was instead half obliterated. What many in Nagasaki rage against, however, is not fate but foul play. In Hiroshima, many believe they were bombed for experimental purposes or to justify the $2 billion investment in the Manhattan Project, but a large number seem to accept the official American explanation that the bombing, however cruel, was intended merely to bring the savage war to an end. The residents of Nagasaki do not accept that explanation for the bombing of their city. They cannot understand why destroying one city and 100,000 of its citizens in one fell swoop was not a sufficient demonstration of U.S. superiority over what had become a second-rate power. Why couldn't the United States have waited more than 3 days after Hiroshima for Japan to surrender? The reason offered in Nagasaki, and by some historians elsewhere, is that the United States was bent on field testing the plutonium bomb. It had been tested in the New Mexico desert on July 16, 1945, the so-called Day of Trinity, but in that case it was detonated on the ground. There was no proof that such a weapon could be exploded in the air. The uranium bomb was first used at Hiroshima because it was considered fail-safe, but making the uranium bomb was far too time-consuming and expensive. The plutonium bomb was clearly the weapon of choice. Without a field test, however, the scientists would not know if it would work or what its effects might be. And it was, in fact, the plutonium bomb that was built and tested exclusively after Nagasaki. Others believe the bomb was dropped on Nagasaki not to frighten Emperor Hirohito, but to impress Joseph Stalin. The B-29 boxcar took off from Tinian only hours after the Soviet Union had finally declared war on Japan and began moving troops into Manchuria. President Truman's Secretary of State, James F. Byrnes, and atomic scientist J. Robert Oppenheimer, who later invented the H-bomb, were only, I beg your pardon, Oppenheimer did not. And atomic scientist J. Robert Oppenheimer, he was the one primarily responsible for the first Hiroshima bomb, were only two of the many high-level officials who later admitted that preventing the Soviets from gaining ground in Asia and staking any claim to Japan was a prime concern in the summer of 1945. The same dramatic show of strength that might shock Tokyo into surrender could also intimidate the Soviets and allow the Americans to dictate our own terms at the end of the war, as Barnes later put it. The atomic bombings, Truman wrote, gave the world a chance to face the facts. Many U.S. military leaders, including General Dwight Eisenhower, General Douglas MacArthur, and Admiral Chester Nimitz, declared years later that the war would have ended in 1945 without the use of atomic weapons. Just before Hiroshima and Nagasaki were bombed, Truman rejected the concept of a Japanese surrender that would allow the emperor to keep his throne. After the atomic bombings, Truman accepted that very condition and called the surrender unconditional, and that's a quote. 100,000 had died, hundreds of thousands more were fated to suffer or die, and the emperor remained on the throne. What had changed? The plutonium bomb had been field-tested successfully, and the Soviet advance had been checked. But at what price? Besides the casualties, this display of force helped create and set the tone for the Cold War and guaranteed that a nuclear arms race would develop. The ambiguous Hiroshima bomb could have been read by the Soviets as nothing more than a war-ending weapon, but the Nagasaki bomb was probably seen for what it was, the first strike in the battle to control the post-war world. And that was by Greg Mitchell, Forgotten Bomb, Forgotten City. And that was the bombing of Nagasaki. Sorry for the dead air. I was looking for something that I guess I had not brought. A poem written by my niece, whose birthday was either the 7th or yesterday, and she just published a new book of poetry, her second, and she calls it the Manifesto. And what she does is she takes out words from the Communist Manifesto of Marx and Engels and makes poetry out of it. And for some stupid reason, I forgot to bring it this morning. But anyway, also happy birthday to my niece, and I shall bring it next week and maybe read a couple of selections out of it. It's a very interesting book. And again, today is the 67th anniversary of Nagasaki. Sorry I said Oppenheimer was the, he was actually the one purged by the person who developed the hydrogen bomb and was persona non grata in American circles from then on, taken out of every clearance, the works. At any rate, on this beginning to be a lovely day, summer day, this has been Michael McCusker. Perhaps I'll see you next week if the sky doesn't fall or the river rise or a drone drop down on top of me. And this is Coast Community Radio, Radio Free Columbia Pacific.